The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And this week on Where Did the Road Go, we have Scotty Roberts, who is the author of a couple of books and a third one coming out very soon. The first being called The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim, and a second one that, we're going to talk to him about all three, actually. A second one about reptilians. Are you there with us, Scotty?
I am indeed, Soraya. Nice to be here.
Oh, it's nice to have you. You have quite the resume, actually.
Uh-oh.
You're also the publisher of Intrepid Magazine.
I am.
We've had a few of your contributors on over the few months here. And you also are the editor-in-chief of the Ghost Hunters official publication, huh?
I used to be. I worked for Taps Paramagazine as the editor-in-chief back and resigned out of there in December of 2010. And the very next day launched Intrepid Magazine. We've been around, we're in our third year with Intrepid Mag.
Okay, all right. So you were there at the beginning with them.
Yes.
All right. What do you think of the proliferation of like supernatural reality shows and stuff?
You know, I think it gets a little overdone after a while. My wife and I were just watching the other night, just caught by chance, some new show that's done out of, I don't even know where it is, Hillbilly Boys or something, Redneck Boys, Appalachian Boys, some show like that. And we were watching that, and they were all big guys dressed in black t-shirts, and some of them with baseball caps, all doing the same kind of stuff we've seen done with the same kind of equipment we've seen done. So all it really is a different show. It's like, just try to think of two shows, House versus Grey's Anatomy. Mm. Two different doctor shows with different sets of actors and stuff. They all pretty much do the same thing. And so, I hope I didn't offend any medical show watchers there. But and that's what I thought. I watched and I was intrigued. I wanted to see what they got and how they went about doing what they did. But it just seemed like, as we used to say in more harsher terms, the same doo-doo, different ship. So that was my take on it. My take on proliferation of paranormal shows in general, is that I haven't seen anything new and unique done. And I guess when it comes down to it, being able to do things in a different way, there's only so many ways you can do ghost investigations. There's newer equipment, there's more sensitive equipment to pick different things up, but it's all pretty much the same thing. It's the setting, it's the how do you make a program interesting.
Right.
And that's what the producers have to do, with hopefully not tainting the reality of the show. They've got to show something to the viewing audience that makes that show worth watching. And because the evidence isn't really any different than the kinds of evidence you get out if you go out and do your own kind of ghost hunting with that equipment. So
yeah.
It's the same old, same old.
And it seems like anything like that, you're going to end up with some fraudulent stuff slipping in, whether it's from the investigators or maybe the producers or someone
right.
along the line, just because they need to keep those ratings up, you know?
Exactly. And that's the sad case with a show like that, is you're going to run headlong into that sooner or later if you have scrupulous producers. If you've got producers that are going to want to present things as they are, you may have a really boring television show. And so the show becomes a show about the personalities doing it, as opposed to necessarily the overt, over-the-top types of evidence they might be getting, which would be it's very rare and few and far between. Most of those things I find happen when your recorder is off, your camera is shut down. That's when you get the best evidence of all, and it's anecdotal evidence. It's stuff that happens in front of your face as opposed to in front of a lens.
Yeah, yeah. And plus, it seems like the paranormal has a little bit of subjective reality to it that makes it that much harder to pin down.
Indeed. Indeed. So you really don't know what you're getting. When you do get something, how do you know it's a ghost? You really don't know that.
That's been my point for a long time.
See, I had a session, and I know this is not what we were going to talk about as a topic, but let me share this with you. I had a little session with one of the spirit boxes, and my 16-year-old daughter at the time, this is about 5 years ago, we were sitting out at, we lived in a house out on a ranch out in the middle of nowhere in godforsaken cow country in Wisconsin. And we're sitting there at about 10 at night, and I'm hearing this voice come through that identifies itself as Andy. And I said, could you clarify that? Andy, this thing said. Now, mind you, this box is only a speaker. It rotates on a frequency, and it gives you voices that come in, and they float over the frequency. But when you ask questions or pose questions, you're not speaking into a microphone, so there's no way for you to broadcast anything anywhere. If somebody was hoaxing this, they would have to know exactly where you were and be sitting outside your house with the equipment to be able to transmit in and catch the frequency that you're on, which you're not on a frequency. It's spinning.
All right.
And so we're getting this voice, and it identified itself as my aunt who had passed on. My daughter asked the question, do you see me here? Do you remember who I am? And the voice said, I see you there. You're pretty now. And this voice went on to ask me questions. Where is Janie? It asked me, which is my mother, her sister. And just out of the blue, where is Janie? And so we had a little going back and forth. I had no idea who I was talking to. But it was interesting that the voice that was there seemed to know details about me and asked me pertinent details about... and, of course, somebody could say, well, somebody was obviously out there transmitting in. Well, nobody knew I was doing this.
Right.
And it's at night, out in the middle of the country, in the middle of nowhere. So that's my experience with that kind of a piece of equipment, is that I have found that there are things out there that are real, but can you define them and explain them? Not necessarily. To say that was the ghost of my aunt would be... I couldn't do that with any certainty.
Right.
But something was there communicating with me that knew something about me. And so that made it very interesting and a bit creepy at the same time.
I bet. Well, we've seen that in UFO encounters, too, where they seem to know things that they shouldn't be able to know about people.
That's right.
So, I mean, maybe there's a connection there between what we're experiencing in both cases.
Yes.
And you attended Bible college and were pursuing a master's in divinity.
That's true. That was many years ago now. I was in Bible school. I was in seminary. And these are the things. I was in a very conservative, fundamentalist, Baptist setting and up in Minnesota. And I was a youth pastor for a while after that, for many years, working. Most of the jobs I did as a youth pastor were alongside my career in advertising. So I was a full-time youth pastor and a full-time creative director in advertising. And because most of the churches I worked with just couldn't afford to budget a full-time person to do that.
Right.
And so I worked with kids, high school kids and so on, for several years. And this was the period where I really started questioning certain things about my faith. And it didn't really hit me on a faith level at that time as it did a level of church polity, church mechanics, how things worked. And then dealing with the things in church that you deal with in everyday life, the gossiping, the politics over spirituality, things like that. And that began to bother me. It bothered me that we seem to have a form of religion in our denomination. That's what we stuck to. But there were so many questions I had that seemed to make that fall short. And so when I was in seminary, I would ask a lot of questions. And I generally got told that I was a troublemaker. And it was either one of my seminary professors who became the president of that seminary, he's now the chair of history at Northwestern up here. He would give me kind of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Well, you asked that question, but we'll have to talk about that when we're at coffee. And then I would get you're a troublemaker, Roberts. If you're not careful, you better mind your P's and Q's here. You'll be out of here on your ear. And it was questions that some of the first questions I had revolved around the Nephilim and the names of God and the characters involved with the Nephilim. We hear the terms, the Anunnaki and the Nephilim, and all of these have become very pop cultural terms within the whole ancient alien arena. Mm-hmm. And the reason I wrote a book on that, my first book with New Page Books, was The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim. And I wanted to go back to the Genesis story because that is the source point of the word Nephilim. It's a Hebrew word out of the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament. And there's in Genesis 6, it talks about, and in those days the sons of God came down and intermingled with the daughters of men and had children by them. And they were known as the Nephilim, and they were on the earth in those days and also afterward. And they became known as the heroes of old and the men of renown. And then the passage stops. It's just this kind of, and here we're presenting you the facts about the Nephilim. Make sure you write it down in your syllabus so we can move on to the flood and the Noah's and the Ark story right after it. And there's no negative or positive mention. There's no judgment cast on these beings in this passage or anything. It's just a mention. And what I didn't know at the time and never made the connection even in seminary was that this is the preamble to the flood story. These beings coming down and impregnating human women, and then God getting pissed off by that and wanting to wipe them all out. And he uses the flood as a means for that. And everything we've been taught about the flood seems to me also to be things that need to be questioned. If you were in a Judeo-Christian setting and you were taught about the flood story, Noah and the Ark and the animals two by two, and he built the ark and the people all perished, it was because of the wickedness of mankind, and Noah was the only righteous man, that's why he was chosen, you got the story wrong, even though that's what we've been taught for generations. And the story is really a story of judgment on this hybrid offspring in context as it appears in the book of Genesis chapter 6. And this judgment is brought on by a great flood to wipe them out. And Noah was chosen because, not because he was a righteous man, as the English reads, but in the Hebrew it says he was a pure-blooded man, pure in all his generations back to Adam. And that has significance. And I can tell you, I'll tell you what that is in a minute here. But then the wickedness of mankind was what we were always taught was the reason for the flood when we were sitting in Sunday school. But that's not what the Hebrew says. The Hebrew talks about the wickedness brought to mankind, making mankind evil by the impregnation and the impurity brought to the human bloodline. And when you start looking at that, you get a hint at why Noah, being chosen as the only pure-blooded man, who it says was pure in all his generations, was chosen. It's because everyone else was of this tainted blood of the Nephilim, of the watchers, if you will, as the book of Enoch calls them, the watchers, the sons of God, who came down and impregnated humans. And then you have to look at the Hebrew term for the sons of God in that passage. It talks about the sons of God are, in the Hebrew, the B'nai HaElohim. And the Elohim are a group known as, in the Old Testament, very obscure places you can find them in the Old Testament, the Divine Council. This is a council that rules in heaven, and God seems to preside over them. But Elohim is also the name for God. It's one of the many names used for God in the Old Testament, but it's the one that's used the most. It's used almost 3,000 times as a name for God in the Old Testament. And the word literally means El, being the Hebrew word for God, and Him, being a Hebrew suffix tacked onto a word to denote plurality. So Elohim literally means God of or among many gods. Hmm. And this is the name for God all through the Old Testament. And it's also a word that can be used singularly or plurally, depending on how its context is, it's fit into the context of a sentence. So it could be like our English word for deer. Deer. I see a deer, singular, in the front yard. I see a herd of deer, plural, in the backyard. A singular of a plural. A herd of deer. A singular herd of plural deer. And so rabbinic scholars and Christian scholars alike have said this is merely a word for God, saying God is a singular God with a multitude of majesty and power. And yet, there is a passage in Psalm 82. If you look in your Bible at Psalm 82, it'll read in the English, And God stood in the midst of the gods, and or in the midst of the divine council, and he said to them, you are all gods, the bright shining princes of heaven. That was difficult enough for me to decipher when I was in seminary, when it was in English. Then you look at it in Hebrew. And Elohim stood, singular, in the midst of the Elohim, plural. And he, singular, said to them, plural, you are all Elohim, the bright shining princes of heaven. And these are the same characters, I believe, that are the Bnei HaElohim, the sons of Elohim, those of the Elohim, in other words, who descended and impregnated human women and bequeathed the Nephilim in the book of Genesis, launching a widespread tainting of the human bloodline, so much so that there was only, according to the biblical account, one man left. Now, you look at this account as it stands in Genesis. There are over 600 different ancient flood stories of this nature throughout human culture, religion, tribal stories, and linked with all of these flood stories are the, in most of them, are the descending of gods or spirit beings or some extraterrestrial, not of this earth type of beings that impregnate human women, and some superior god or superior power is pissed off at them and wants to wipe them all out. And uses a flood as the means. And this is common to over 600 different stories in our ancient past. So outside of the Hebrew story in the book of Genesis, you have 599 plus other stories that tell the same kind of thing. And that makes you ask questions. Well, are they all referring to the same thing? There's different stories. There's different types of beings that are listed. Who are these guys really? And then to take it just one step further, you go back to Genesis 1, where God talks about, you know, the Bible talks about God creating the heavens and the earth. And then it goes into 3, he creates Adam and Eve and places them in the garden to till the ground and to keep it for him. And there is the serpent character that we find there. And we were always told and taught that this is Satan, it's Lucifer, it's the devil. But the funny thing is, those names never appear in the passage. What does appear in the passage, and by the way, Lucifer is never connected to the serpent in the garden until over 1,000 years later, when they attribute very loosely the serpent in the garden to that serpent, the devil, they say. And yet the word itself in Genesis is the word nakosh for the serpent. And nakosh is, by definition, the bringer of knowledge, the illuminator, the bright shining one. As a matter of fact, that same word, a derivation is used of it later when Moses is leading the children of Israel out of Egypt and they're all being bitten by serpents, and he casts a nakoshta off of the word nakosh, a nakoshta, a bright brazen serpent on a pole, and raises it up, and whoever looks at it will be healed. And it's funny that the serpent, nakosh, and the nakoshta are both offshoots of the same word, yet one represents such evil and the other represented such good, and depended on how you were using it. And when you look at Nakosh in the story of Adam and Eve, he's presenting knowledge, and Eve just takes the knowledge. And according to Genesis 3, if you read this, it says right after that, it says, and Elohim said, the humans have eaten of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and become just like us, plural. Let us, therefore, prevent them from also eating of the tree of life at the center of the garden, lest they become eternal like us. And then God comes down and curses everybody. And so there's a plurality in God in the Old Testament. And these Nephilim seem to be... Now, of course, we're talking all within the context of this mythology. And if you will, whether you believe it or not, as truth about Adam and Eve, about all these stories we're talking about, or whether you think it's mythology, the way I am describing it is I'm trying to step outside the box of having been in that faith and say I've got to push that box over there and look at it from the outside so I can decipher it in relation to all the other mythologies that correlate to it around the world.
Right.
And so I don't want to offend anybody's religious sensibilities or their spirituality or their faith or their denomination or their religion, but really what you end up with in the Bible, with the Nephilim, are a cast of gods and minor gods over whom Elohim presided. And so for all that we are taught that the Old Testament is a monotheistic book, collection of books, it really is not.
It just kind of morphed into it over time.
Yes, it's how we deciphered it. And so those were some of my big questions when I was in seminary. And that's what led me to stray off of that path. And I guess you could say right now I have pretty much become an agnostic. Mm. I'm not an atheist. I don't know enough to be an atheist. I don't know what all is out there to say it doesn't exist.
Right.
But I can say I don't know, and I'm searching and I'm seeking. And that's where I am right now. And I have found that the study of these things, the study of, I mentioned to you when we were off air, my new book on Moses and the Exodus reality. Mm-hmm. What these things do for me is these are all ways that I look into the historical record, the archaeological record, and I can say this. I can prove that the history of the Bible is efficacious. I can prove other things by archaeology, historical data, but what I can't do is I can't prove the existence of God by these things. And so the research leaves you empty on a spiritual realm. It just gives you, it may bolster your faith a bit, but at the same time, it's presenting you facts. And you're trying to decipher through these facts to find out what is right and what is true. And that's the hardest part with any of this, is I can look at the story of the Nephilim, and I can say, this is the Hebrew story, the Hebrew version of these events. But then I can go to the Tuatha De Danann, the ancient Celtic, ancient Irish version of these stories, and they talk about the bright, shining kings who descended from heaven, came down to earth, and taught us the knowledge of the gods and impregnated the humans, and there were great wars, and they were driven back into the hollow hills and became known as they receded as the elven folk, or those of the Elohim. And so you've got these stories like this all around the world in all these different cultures with different spins and twists on them, and it leaves you at sometimes a bit bewildered, and you say, I don't even know what is true anymore. So I just have to go with the facts. And if God is there, God will reveal himself to me the way he chooses.
And it's also hard to take all these separate stories that all basically say the same thing and just say, well, it's a coincidence.
Well, that's the thing. It can't be just a coincidence. When you really boil all these stories down, there's a common thread. And that common thread is a thread of race interrupted. And as I mentioned, Noah being called the only righteous man, in the Hebrew meant the only pure-blooded man, because from the time of Eden, I believe that the whole scenario in Eden was a sexual encounter, that Eve was impregnated by Nakosh and also impregnated by Adam. I don't know if they had some, you know, Edenic three-way going on there, if it was at different times. But I know this, even my own twin daughters, who are now 21, when they were, the day they were born, the doctor said, well, they were conceived 10 days apart. Bryn is 10 days less developed than Abby.
Huh.
And I said, I didn't know that was even possible.
Yeah.
She said, it's just a fraternal pregnancy with two different conception dates. Okay. Well, what happened with Eve is, and I believe the whole passage in Genesis bears this out, she was impregnated by Nakosh. And she was also impregnated by Adam, and her sons, or twin sons, were Cain and Abel. And Cain was then literally the first of the Nephilim, because he was part human and part Elohim. And Abel was pure human. Now, if you notice, after the fall, God comes down and curses them all. And he says to the serpent, he utters what is considered to be the first prophecy of the Messiah in the Bible, and that is in Genesis in the Garden of Eden, where God's cursing Nakosh. He says, and you will bite his heel, but he will return and bite your head and crush your head. It's a messianic prophecy in code poetic language. Now, in the Jewish system, the Messiah came to be known as the kinsman redeemer, the one who would be one of us, Redeemer. And I always wondered, why was that significant? Well, you know why? It's because the next thing God says to Adam and Eve and the serpent is, and there will be constant enmity or conflict between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the human. And meaning there is a dual seed. And when you hear the kinsman redeemer, the one of us, the one who would be one of us, you look at all the genealogies and the chronologies all through the Old Testament saying who begat whom and who begat whom. This was all to trace the line of the Messiah. And then it gets to Noah and it says he was a pure-blooded man, pure in all his generations back to Adam, and this is why he was chosen. But they never follow the line through the firstborn, which is the tradition. Cain. And there's a reason why. And they can't through Abel. Abel's dead.
Right.
They trace the human bloodline through Seth, the third born of Adam and Eve, because Cain was not of pure human blood. And the whole Old Testament, the whole story of the Messiah coming, the kinsman redeemer, the one who would be one of us redeemer, obviates the opposite. There was one who was not one of us, a bloodline that was not of pure human blood. And this is what sets you up for the whole reptilian argument that comes out of this. It stems out of this. It stems from the whole serpent seed doctrine that says Cain was the son of Nakash and Eve, and that there was an impregnation, an adulteration of the human bloodline, and that they coexisted all these years. And God tried to wipe them out with the flood, but was ineffective, because it says they were on the earth those days and also afterward. Mm-hmm. And you look at the remnant all the way down through, and then it goes from there, this whole reptilian reference, it goes all the way back 1,500 to 2,000 years earlier than the writing of the book of Genesis to, guess who, the Anunnaki, the Sumerian culture. And all the gods start to have the same names, the events are similar, and it becomes an amazing story that's been rewritten in the book of Genesis.
All right. Well, this is obviously where you went into the writing about reptilians was from your work on the Nephilim. And why did you focus in on reptilians? Just because they seem to be the core of it?
Well, they
or
are
the imagery?
There's this great mythos about them. You know, you hear more and more stories nowadays, especially, you know, the reptilian. Ooh, there's this secret reptilian race that came from the star system of Draco, and they came to this planet and they impregnated primordial humans, or they bred them up, genetically engineered a human race to be a slave race, and they were subdued by the reptilian race that was already present on this planet, the terrestrial reptilians. And there they remain in stealth, behind the scenes, working even behind the Illuminati to run the affairs of this planet.
Now,
and that's the basic theory.
And this came primarily from David Icke.
Primarily, this came from David Icke, who based it on watching the television. Yeah, admittedly, he said watching the television series V in the 1970s really helped him establish his theory. And also basing it on some of Zechariah Sitchin's works. The problem with that, though, is when you go back to the Sumerian culture, there isn't really a reptilian tie-in. The Anunnaki are never said to be reptilian in nature. It's said that they created humans, they enslaved them, just like the reptilians were supposed to have done. But there was one god who has a reptilian connection. Just like in the Garden of Eden, Nakash, the serpent character, is serpentine. He has a serpentine connection. Doesn't say he's a snake. He's a reptilian character. And what you've got in the Sumerian culture, you've got their chief god, Elil, says to the rest of the gods, I'm so tired of doing all the work. We're digging our own canals and mining our own resources and tilling our own ground. Let us therefore create primeval men to do our work for us. And he conscripts his brother god Enki, who is also known as Ea, so I always refer to him as Enki Ea, to do this. And they create humans, and the humans are enslaved, and lo and behold, as time goes on, you read in these cuneiform tablets the tale of Atrahasis, the human king. Atrahasis is the king of the city of Eridu in ancient Sumeria. And they're on the backwaters of the Euphrates River, surrounded by the marshy lands known as the Serpent's Marsh, which plays a big role here. And he calls out to his god, their patron god of the city, Enki. And he says, hear our cry, O Lord, deliver us from this evil of slavery and bend your ear to your servant Atrahasis and so on. It sounds very biblical. And it says that Enki heard the plight of his servant, and he and his mighty warriors came down to the earth, disseminated the forbidden knowledge of the gods to the humans, helped Atrahasis and his men, his armies, rebel against Elil, the chief god, and they won their freedom from enslavement to the gods. And for this act, Elil, the chief god, condemns Enki and all his followers to the subterranean caverns of the earth to dwell forever. Now, if you start looking at the similarities to the Genesis story written about in the early 1400s BC, you've got a story where God, known as El, is an updated version, if you will, of the word Elil. Elil, through the migration of humanity and religion from the Fertile Crescent down to the Canaanite region, Elil, over 1,500 years, became El, the base word for God, which became Elohim, El Shaddai, El Elyon, and all of those. Enki, known as Iyah, over that same migration, over 1,500 years, becomes known as Yahweh in the Canaanite culture, which is the base word in the Hebrew tongue for Jehovah. So Elil and Enki Iyah become El, Elohim, and Jehovah. And then it says in the Sumerian story that they create primeval men to do their work for them, to till their ground, mine their resources. In the Genesis story, it says God created Adam and Eve and placed them in the garden to do what? To till the ground and keep it for him. And then you've got the rebellion of the humans, and this is where Atrahasis calls on Enki, and Enki rises up out of the great underground sea, the Yabzu, the underworld sea, and he comes up into the Serpent's Marsh, which surrounds the city of Eridu. It's known as the Serpent's Marsh, and still today. And the Serpent's Marsh also became known as Enki Iyah. It became as Iyah's Den, or Iyaden, or Eden, if you will, when you get into the Old Testament. And Eden becomes the place where the serpent, not rising up out of the Serpent's Marsh, but the serpent character, impregnates Eve and disseminates the forbidden knowledge of the gods. And these are the similarities you have in these old stories, where I believe Moses, when he wrote the book of Genesis, and I don't believe there's any reason to doubt he existed, by the way, that's the whole thrust of the Exodus reality coming out in October, is that Moses was a real guy. I can identify him, identify the pharaohs around him. Remember, he may have been born Israelite, but he was raised Egyptian, and for 40 years he was thoroughly Egyptian. Moses was an Egyptian. The same way I have Scottish roots, but I am an American. So Moses, the Egyptian, he's a crown prince of Egypt, the man who I believe he is. He was a hereditary crown prince of Egypt. He was the grand vizier of Egypt. All of these things. When he leaves Egypt, according to the biblical story, Moses murders a taskmaster and then flees for fear of his life. That's a whole other story we can get into another time, what that's all about. But he flees and he goes directly from Egypt, being part of the royal court and part of the royal family there, and he flees to Midian in the Sinai Peninsula. And he marries the daughter of a pagan high priest. And he learns the Sinaitic religions, the Canaanite religions, the Sumerian religions. And Moses, for 80 years of his life, according to the biblical chronology, is a guy that was purely Egyptian, purely immured in other Middle Eastern religions, and did not even know who Jehovah was until his burning bush experience, or his, what would you call it, his private, personal, spiritual experience, his epiphany at age 80, is the first time he becomes a Jehovah worshiper. And then he goes and leads these people out and so on. Then during the next 40 years, while they're all in the wilderness, as he's growing older and older, he writes the first five books of the Bible. He writes the law and all of these things. And so there were reasons he put these stories in there. It's because he went back to Sumerian religion, to Canaanite religion, and he built Judaism out of whole cloth. He created something that had not existed before on the basis of his belief that he had a spiritual experience. Now, keep in mind, nobody else was there. Nobody else saw it. Nobody else wrote about it. Moses was the guy who experienced it and said, this happened, and he wrote about it. He said, this shall be our God. And remember, when he led the Israelites out of Egypt, they weren't even Jehovah worshipers. If they even knew who Jehovah was, I'd be surprised. If you remember at the mountain of God, the Mount Sinai, and Moses is up at the mountain, the people actually say, this is a couple of weeks after the Exodus. They're looking at Moses' brother Aaron and saying, and literally in the vernacular of the Hebrew text, it says this, where's this guy, Moses? He led us out of Egypt, but where's he now? Build us a god. And Aaron casts the golden calf, and we know the whole story after that. These were not Jehovah worshipers. And so when Moses wrote these things about the Nephilim and the Elohim, he took them from Sumerian culture and other borrowed religions and created his stories and created his religion. And so that's another factor when you start looking at these things and saying, wait a minute, was he right? Or was there some proto-religion on which he based everything? Or was he borrowing information, creating something in order to lead a people? Okay. And I think that's what happened.
Well, I mean, Egypt has a pretty long history, so it's entirely possible he got some of it, at least, from Egyptian records.
Sure.
We got to take a quick 45-second break. We will be back with Scotty Roberts in, 45 seconds.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And our guest tonight is Scotty Roberts, and we've been talking about, we've been talking about a lot of stuff.
Kind of bouncing around.
And your latest book, though, I don't even think we mentioned the name of your latest book, and that is what?
The one that's coming out in October?
The one that's out now, The Secret History of the Reptilians.
The Secret History of the Reptilians. It's subtitled The Pervasive Presence of the Serpent Throughout Human History, Religion, and Alien Mythos.
And you are not promoting the idea that they are running the Illuminati who are running the world.
I'm not. As I mentioned to you, I think some people have been a little disappointed with the book because they're like, he doesn't even believe reptilians exist. Now, that's not true. I just state I don't know whether they exist. And I cannot prove they exist on the scant bits of information that are out there. Now, if you wanted to line up anecdotal evidence, meaning the thousands of people who say they've seen reptilians, has experienced them, they've channeled them, they've encountered them and interacted with them, you might have something. But anecdotal evidence is not provable as evidence. If I come to you and all your listeners and say, I saw a ghost last night, does that prove to you that ghosts exist? Now, perhaps there is an element that says, if someone is credible and has a long history of being a credible person says something like that, then perhaps there's something to their story, or they were drunk, or they had something going on. They dreamt it.
Misinterpretation.
Right. So the bottom line for reptilians is, for me, is not that they don't exist. Hell, they probably exist in one form or another. The problem is I cannot prove they exist, and neither can anybody else, unless they just simply prove it to themselves because they had an experience. Right. And then they become like Moses at the burning bush. He's the only guy who saw it there, and he's the only guy who can really believe it because he saw it and experienced it.
Yeah.
And that's the same kind of take. This book deals with the reptilian mythos as it builds off of all the cultures that had reptilian factors to them, which says something right there. It talks about going from the biblical account of the Nephilim and the remnant of the Nephilim, and how it goes into even things about the whole Holy Grail issue. The Arthurian legend of the Holy Grail is connected to this story. The Merovingians, if you know anything about them.
I wanted you to get into that a little bit. You want to tell people a little about that?
Sure, I'll give you just a brief highlight. The Merovingians were a dynasty of kings that lived in the Franco region of Europe, France, in the Dark Ages, if you will, the 300s to the 700s AD. And the founder of this dynasty, his name was Merovic, and he made the claim that he had coursing through his veins, the blood of Jesus and the bloodline of Lucifer. And he says that his mother was impregnated by his father, who was of the line of Jesus, that Jesus had offspring, and that his father was a direct descendant. But that his mother also, after becoming pregnant, went swimming in the surf in the ocean, and the great beast, the Luciferian beast, came up and raped and impregnated her. And she dually conceived one child, Merovic. And now this either showed, I say rather jokingly, this is one of two things. This either shows how uneducated people were back then about biology, or it shows that Merovic was spinning quite a tale and expecting that people would believe it. And so he did not have a firm grasp on biology, or he did, and he knew he was duping the people leading them on. So it goes from there that this dynasty really starts setting the stage for the whole serpent seed doctrine, this doctrine that Jesus and Lucifer both were of the same bloodline, which really links into the whole Elohim issue, that they were both of the Elohim. They were both sons of God. They both had similar titles, Lucifer being the star of the morning, Jesus being the bright and morning star. Different titles given to them. There are some people that come up with theories that say they are even one and the same. And there are those that say that they are brother gods, both part of the Elohim. Which I don't think is so far-fetched when you look at some of the things we talked about at the beginning of the show.
Right.
And so this doctrine, if you will, about the bloodline of Christ, the bloodline, this reptilian bloodline of Lucifer, this all started spilling up into, you start getting all the way up into the 1800s, and you've got your theosophists who were teaching that, we were all from Atlanteans, we all were from the ghosts of the Atlanteans, so, and then they were hijacked by the German revivalist groups that put this other spin on it, this darker spin. Not only are we children of Atlanteans, but we are children of Lucifer. We are children of this bloodline, this seed, this reptilian race. And these are the things that even the Nazis picked up, and Hitler started promoting these things. And Hitler was looking for these things and all of these different occultist things that tied into this. And this is really the daisy train, in a nutshell, that leads you up to that whole reptilian theory today. There's even esoteric Nazism today, where they believe that the ghost of Adolf Hitler can empower you. But it's all linked. It starts becoming linked with the whole Grail theory, or I'm sorry, the Grail legends. It becomes linked with the reptilians. It becomes linked with the beings that have governed our bloodlines since time immemorial in our past. And so it's quite an interesting string to follow.
Yeah, I had never heard about the ghost of Hitler one.
Esoteric Nazism.
All right. There was also something about Rh negative blood.
Yes, there is something about the Rh negative blood, and that there, back in the mid 1950s, they stumbled upon the Rh negative factor in human blood, and they're like, "Eureka! This is something that," and they made this statement. I don't think they were talking about extraterrestrials at the time, but they did say, this doesn't exist anywhere on the planet. There's no linkage to it anywhere. And this is what some reptilian theorists grasped onto as being this remnant gene of the reptilians. Because and they come up with all these things to talk about. Well, the people that have this Rh negative factor blood, they're more sensitive to light. Their body temperature's a little cooler. They have slit vertical irises. I added that one for free. But all these other things, they try to make these reptilian connections. They might be onto something there, but again, since there's no source point to go to, there is no way to prove the theory. But it stands out there, and there's a lot of speculation based on hypothesizing. And so the Rh factor in the blood, if you've got Rh negative blood, you just might be a reptilian. Here's your sign.
Huh. The I completely forgot my question.
Right. No, that's okay. I forget where I am all the time.
Well, let's now your next book, you plan on having this one out. What's the name of it?
The new book is entitled The Exodus Reality. Okay. And it's subtitled Unearthing the Real Historical Moses, Identifying the Pharaohs, and Examining the Exodus from Egypt.
And this will be out when?
This comes out in October of this year. As a matter of fact, we'll be premiering it at the Paradigm Symposium up in St. Paul this year.
Yeah, tell people a little about that before we get into the book.
Sure. Paradigm Symposium. This is, I created Intrepid Magazine, and then I was talking with my cohort, Micah Hanks, about a year and a half ago and said, we got to do a symposium of some sort. Now, let's put together, I said, we did all these with the Ghost Hunters when I was with them, and I see all these paranormal things and UFO things. I said, why don't we put together something that really appeals on an intellectual, critical thinking level, alternative scientific, alternative type of event. And we came up with the Paradigm Symposium, which we thought was a really original name at the time. And, the Paradigm Symposium. We had our first event last October, with the likes of Eric Von Daniken and all the guys from the Talking Heads from the History Channel's Ancient Aliens, and a bunch of authors you'd recognize, and it was very successful. Hmm. And so and I'm talking successful on the realm of people came and then people left and said, we need more of this. That was amazing. And just for the record, anecdotally, we didn't make a dime. Hmm. But we lost personal money on this. But it was a highly successful event in that it got people interested in talking about these things. And so we're doing it again this year. And this year we have an amazing cast of characters again. We've got Robert Bovall, Egyptologist. He wrote Breaking the Mirror of Heaven and the Egypt Code and all of these. You've seen him on Ancient Aliens. You've seen him in almost every Egyptological documentary on cable channels.
Right.
Scott Walter, he's the host of H2's America Unearthed. Mm-hmm. We'll be here. Robert Scoach. I always want to say Scoach.
It's Shock.
Shock. And before I knew how to pronounce his name, I said, this Robert Scoach guy, we're going to get him?
Oh, yeah. I had no idea the first time I read his name.
S-C-H-O-C-H. Shock. He's a geologist, a geophysicist, an author. He's been on Ancient Aliens and all these other documentary shows as well. Wrote the big book on the water damage of the Sphinx.
We've actually had him on here twice.
Amazing man.
Yes, he is.
We had him on our, John and I interviewed him about a week ago. So, on our show. L.A. Marzulli, who wrote the Nephilim trilogy, the best-selling, and he does the Watchers series. He's going to be here. Dr. John Ward, my cohort. He's an archaeologist and an author, and he's going to be presenting Nick Redfern, the prolific Nick Redfern, who we used to say jokingly, by the time you and I are done talking, Nick Redfern will have pumped out another 72,000-word book.
Yeah.
So, but he doesn't write anything vapid and wasteful, that's for sure. He is quite the mind.
Yeah.
We've got Laird Scranton, is the author of the books on the Dogon and Forgotten Civilization.
As well as one on Velikovsky.
Velikovsky Heresies, which he spoke on last year. Amazing man, dealing with linguistics and ancient linguistics and the tieovers and the... an amazing person. He's actually going to interview him for my own radio show next week.
Oh.
So, Anthony F. Sanchez, author and researcher. He wrote The UFO Highway. He's got Scepter Radio. David Weatherly, who, by the way, says hello to you tonight. Oh. Talking to him, chatting with him just before I came on your show.
Oh, great.
And his new book is coming out, Strange Intruders, which is going to be very interesting. It's a follow-up to his Black Eyed Children book. Dan Mattson, a good friend of mine, who is, he published Star Trek magazines and then the Star Wars magazines, Lucasfilms magazines, Lord of the Rings magazines. everything, and he comes and gives a very wonderful presentation about his life and all of these things that we're interested in, yet he took it to that different angle. His curiosity went into publishing and doing the fanzine type of thing, and but his curiosity and his research is just as sound. Larry Flaxman and Marie D. Jones will be here, co-authors. They're going to be speaking together. Thomas Fusco, Behind the Cosmic Veil. He's got a very scientific approach to the understanding the universe and understanding the paranormal. P.Z. Myers, evolutionary biologist, atheist, crusading atheist from the University of Minnesota, Morris. Father Jack Ashcraft, a Byzantine priest. Dr. John DeSalvo, from the Giza Research Association and his crystal skulls. And then, of course, Micah Hanks and me, we will both be there as well.
Wow.
And it's October 17th through the 20th. If you go to paradigmsymposium.com, you'll see there how to get your tickets and all of that. And I would move kind of quick. We're a little over 30 days out from that event, and tickets are going.
Okay. 30 days out. I thought it was in October.
October. Did I say 30 days? I meant 3 months, 90 days.
Okay. So. All right. That makes
That's
more
me
sense.
That's math.
I know. The question I was going to ask you earlier, we keep bringing up ancient aliens, but isn't it also possible we're looking at a lost civilization that had a different bloodline instead of...
Absolutely. That's absolutely possible. And I think that there are some people who put that forward, that there are civilizations from our primordial past that have resurfaced. I think Göbekli Tepe is a hint at that. We once thought the Sumerian culture was the oldest civilization on the planet up until about 20 years ago. And that dated to about 4,500 to 4,800 BC until, whoa, here comes Göbekli Tepe, this series of round temples and carvings and all of this that were buried meticulously in the sand. Göbekli Tepe dates back another 8,000 years. And so they're wondering, is this something that denotes an ancient culture that we know nothing about? And of course, yes, it does. But where did we come from before that?
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting question. And mankind really erupted onto the scene about 200,000 years ago in one form or another. I don't necessarily believe in the evolutionary ascendancy of man, although I believe evolution does come into play. Things I believe that the whole theory of evolution, I'm not a creationist, but I don't discard that either. But I got to tell you this, there's a little more intelligent design than mass evolutionary scale mutation. And if you look at the evolutionary ascendancy of mankind today, going back to the earliest with the Australopithecus and all the way up the chain, there's not one single piece of DNA that links any of them. And that's why it's still a theory. It's an unproven theory. I believe there's a lot more that went on here. You can talk creation if you want. You can talk ancient civilizations. You can talk paleo contact. However we want to look at this. Maybe it's a combination of all of them. But something happened, and so I couldn't tell you exactly what. Nobody really knows. As my cohort, Dr. John Ward, is so want to say, he says, just remember... He says, we weren't there, and we don't know. So that's his take.
Good quote on that one. So he co-wrote this new book with you.
Mm-hmm. And, yes, sorry, I just took a drink of water, and I did the mm-hmm, and started the yes.
That's fine. And you said there's two different theories that you guys are presenting in this book.
Yes, we have two different theories of the Exodus and who Moses was, separated by about 80 years or two generations. And I basically follow kind of a biblical track. I look at the biblical history, and anybody out there, if you want to argue with me and say, I've had so many people on Facebook and social networks and people write me that say, well, the first reason I'll disregard your research is you use the Bible as viable history. And I say, yeah, that's because the Bible does contain viable history and a hell of a lot of it. So I use the efficacious, viable history of the Bible and set the stage for the dating system. And John uses other events, and frankly, he's not so out of line with the Bible, the biblical's dating system. He just thinks it's a different person than I do.
Now, when
it's on different events.
Now, when you look at the Bible, you're not necessarily talking about the latest translation either. You're looking
not talking about the Good News Bible, you know, or something like that. We're talking about the ancient Hebrew, if you will. You can go to the Torah, the Talmud. You can go to the Mishnah, the Mikvah, the Jewish traditional books, and all of these things. And but if you go to the Bible and you look at what was written there, people say, "Oh, well, the Bible's been so changed over the years." Well, not really. Not a whole hell of a lot. When it really comes down to it, there's little tidbits and pieces that have been changed, but we can go back to the Septuagint written in the 400s BC that were supposedly recompilations of much older books. Do we have the original text in Moses' handwriting? No, we don't. But we have, I know the Septuagint was a reconstruction or a recompiling or rewriting of the Hebrew Old Testament, which is basically the Old Testament we have today, the Hebrew Bible, to do two things: to bolster the faithful and to reestablish the history of Israel as a nation. And both of which were good, wonderful, solid things to do. But when it was rewritten, we think there were things changed, there were things altered, there were embellishments put in place. Does that render all the history null and void? I don't think so. It just means you got to be careful about the biblical history. And so far, most of the things in the Bible that have been brought to task historically or archaeologically have really been proven to be accurate. Now, the thing that brings up discrepancies is the faith stories attached to them. Can I prove that the Red Sea was parted? No. Can I prove that God came down and created the Garden of Eden? No. What I can do with the Red Sea story, though, is I can go to Egyptian history. And I say this. I say where Egyptian history is absolutely devoid of any mention of Moses or the Exodus, you can't find any direct historical data saying that these people existed, that Moses existed, that the Hebrews existed, the Israelites. But what you have to do then is you can go to secondary historical evidence and say, Does this evidence make the story plausible? And plausibility is what you have to go on, because many times you're not going to find many pharaohs who erected these huge structures and built these pylons at Karnak Temple only to tell you about all his victories and also when these bunch of Israelite slaves kicked his ass. You're not going to find it. It just did not exist. And in the region where I believe this took place was northern Egypt, the Memphis area, the northern kingdom. The northern palaces up there, and it's a very wet land. This is where the land of Goshen was in that Nile Delta region. It's wet and humid and flooded all the time, and there is not one scrap in 30 years of some of the archaeological work being done there on one city alone. They have not found a single scrap of surviving papyrus. All they can find are things on stone. Excuse me, and the papyrus are just gone, because they did not survive the flooding and reflooding of Egypt over thousands of years. And you're digging in the mud and you're having to drain the water out of the pits you dig in order to get at the artifacts and the walls of ancient cities and so on. So all of that to say is that there's this extraordinary story in the Bible that has historical pinnings. You can't prove, and this I said this earlier, you can prove that the Bible's history is accurate through archaeology and historical research. You can't prove the existence of God and the efficacy of the spiritual stories. If somebody says the Red Sea was parted, well, that's great. You can't prove that. Can you prove that there was a place the Hebrews would have left from and would have traveled through? Yes, you can. There are even 3,000-year-old places called the Well of Moses up above the north tip of the left finger of the Red Sea. And there's a path that would have led from the land of Goshen in the Delta region. They could have walked right over through. We found that the Red Sea in the Old Testament was a mistranslation into English. It was, and many people know this already, was the Reed Sea, which is the little string of inland seas that trail off of the Suez Canal, goes through all this now, the wetlands up above the tip of the Red Sea. And even now at times, there is a geological thing that takes place on rare occasions where where the winds blow and it dries off some of the very shallow ground, and you can walk over on it and cross the Reed Sea, the Yam Suf, as it's called. And even in the biblical account, it talks about, and Moses stretched the rod over the Red Sea, and a strong east wind blew all night long and parted the waters, it says. And it wasn't instantaneous. It was like, oh, 14 seconds, this Red Sea is parted as a wall on the left and the right. And it wasn't even the big, huge, thick, deep expanse of the Red Sea. It was up in the marshy Yam Suf Lake area that this path would have taken them. Hmm. And then they go directly down the east side of the Red Sea and over inland and into the Sinai wilderness. And this is where they find the Mountain of God. And John and I both visited a little mountain while I was there called Serebet El Khadim, which we both believe is the Mountain of God. And up on top is a 4,000-year-old temple to Hathor, the calf goddess, cow goddess of Egypt. And the ruins are up there now. And remember, I already hinted at this. The people said, who is this guy Moses? Where'd he go? He's up in the mountaintop. And so they built the golden calf to worship. And they built a golden calf because why? They're at the mountain where they are worshiping the golden calf. They're worshiping the calf goddess Hathor, her temple at the top. And so, of course, Moses is there. And I believe the priests were still active there. And I think he went to visit them there and came down with the stele inscripted on both sides of the law. And if you go there to Serebet El Khadim today, it's filled with all these stele written on both sides in hieroglyphs, ranging in size from a foot tall to 9 feet tall, to piles of broken shards of these things all over the place. And I think this is where these things took place. Hmm. And so it's an interesting story. And this is what John and I did. We have these two theories. I believe he was a man who lived under the reign of Hatshepsut, the female pharaoh of Egypt, and that the Exodus took place around 1446 BC. And this is hinged to a key. I'll give you this one hint in the book. In the book of 1 Kings, chapter 6, verse 1, in the Old Testament, it says, on the day that Solomon dedicated the temple in Jerusalem, it was the 480th year since the Exodus. Now, if you can say that the biblical dating system is trustworthy, even though they dispute Solomon, they don't dispute the existence of Temple 1, which is the temple being referred to as Solomon's Temple. And that dates back to 966 BC in Jerusalem. Hmm. You take 966 BC and add on 480, end up with 1446 BC is the date of the Exodus. And if it's that simple, then you start looking at the characters who lived around that time, who were in power in Egypt, and you start coming up with some pretty extraordinary people. John just places it 80 years later by a different chronology of the kings. There's about five or six different Egyptian chronologies of the kings, give or take 20 to 40 years, depending on what pharaoh you recognize or don't recognize or whatever. Mm, okay. And so that's where John's theory comes in.
All right. You're on WVBR FM Ithaca. I got a couple quick questions for you before we end here. Now, the Nephilim were also supposed to be giants, weren't they?
Well, that is a mistranslation.
Okay, that's what I always thought, but...
Yes. The Nephilim are not giants. There was another mythical type of character mentioned as being giant in Jewish literature, but it's still all contained in the Old Testament there. The Nephilim, the word Nephal, is the base word in the Hebrew, to fall, to come down, to descend, to leave one's estate and go to another. Him being the plural suffix, as in Elohim. So Nephilim, those who fell, came down, or left their first estate, left their place, and came to another. That is the Nephilim. Then you have the Giborim, which are the mighty men of old, the men of valor, these mythical creatures, gigantic in size. They were not very happy creatures, but they were mighty warriors who came down and terrorized the planet. And so this is your giants, and they are two totally distinct beings in Hebrew literature.
See, and that was always my understanding, that the term giants was a mistranslation in the modern...
Yes.
Modern, but so many people have used it and connected it to the Nephilim, I started to think I was missing something.
Well, people also claim that the sons of God who came down were angels, and they have for centuries. The only problem is the word for angel in the Hebrew never appears in the text anywhere. Hmm. They're called Elohim, these sons of Elohim. The word for angel is Malach, or Malachi, or Malachim, for plural, and it just does not appear in the text anywhere.
All right. Now, what about some of the lost books of the Bible, like the Book of Enoch and stuff?
That is a book that is no longer lost,
right,
which is good. It's part of the Apocrypha. But this is a book that was booted out of the Bible under the counsels of Constantine. And keep in mind, there was something that Constantine did as the first Christian emperor of Rome. He was trying to do two things. He was trying to establish that there was one religion equaling one empire and one God equaling one emperor. And everything that he did when it came to these books and deciding, he didn't give a rat's ass what they really decided. He just said, I don't care what it is you come to, what conclusion. He says, but there will be unanimity. I will not have an empire run by a religion that's supposed to be a model of my empire that is not unified. And basically the mandate on deciding what books belonged in the Bible was you have to come to unanimous decision. And so, say for the Book of Enoch, it's not that people didn't believe that it was a real scriptural book. It's that they couldn't come to a unanimous decision on it. So it got set aside. And it's really, the Book of Enoch, it's kind of a wild book. It's kind of like the Bible on crack sold to you by Lord of the Rings. And it's got that feel to it. And this is one of the reasons that there was such disagreement on it. It's such fantastical stories in it. And Enoch spends 11 chapters talking about the sons of God, whom he calls the Watchers, and their offspring, the Nephilim. So it's actually a pretty good read. If you've got time and you're looking for something to sit down and read with a hot date, you pull out your copy of the Book of Enoch.
Okay. And do you think there's anything to the idea that Göbekli Tepe could be actually the site of Eden?
It's possible. It's possible. It's in the right area. I know it's in the northwest of Turkey, which is where they place Eden. You can look on a map today, and it says that Eden lie between the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers on the north and the south, with the Gihon and the Pishon rivers running perpendicular, kind of boxing it into that area. Now, of course, if there was a big flood and all the geologic changes since the creation and so on, all of that stuff could be changed. But basically, we still know where the Tigris and the Euphrates are. We do know where the Pishon and the the other one, I just forgot it. I just went blank. Where those little rivers are. And so I think Eden really sat in what is now Iraq and Iran, in that region, and up between the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers. And as a matter of fact, it says when Cain, who I believe was the first of the Nephilim, remember, he murders his brother and he goes running off. He says to God, or I thought it very interesting that God didn't have any conversations with Abel, his righteous man, but he has all kinds of conversations with Cain, the guy who killed him. And Cain said to God, he says, where will I go that men will not know who I am and recognize you for this deed I have done and take my life? And so, there's obviously the big question, where the hell did he go when there's only three people on the planet? And that tells you something. So he goes east, it says, to the land of Nod, and he builds a city called, and he names it. It says he took his wife, lay with his wife, had a child, a man-child, and they named him Enoch. A different Enoch. It's about nine generations chronologically before the Enoch who wrote the Book of Enoch. But he had a son named Enoch, and he builds a city for he and his wife and his kid. And he names it after his son, Enoch. And what's interesting is that in the ancient linguistics of the region, the word Enoch, the E would have become a U, the N would have become an R. It's just the way the linguistics worked. And Enoch is really the city of Uruk, or the ancient word for Iraq. And this is all right up in that region where Göbekli Tepe is. It's all in that basic area. So is Göbekli Tepe possibly Edenic? Maybe. We don't know for sure.
All right. Aren't there some writings in the ancient Jewish texts talking about people that existed before that time period, before Eden?
Not too much. It's very obscure if you can even find it. I can't even think of what they are off the top of my head, unless they're in apocryphal books. Okay. But there is something that even when I was in seminary, conservative seminary, we had a thing we called this illustrious title, the gap theory. And it's that there was a gap between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. Genesis 1:1, the first verse of the Bible says, "And in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth," period. Verse 2, "And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the waters, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters, and said, let there be light," and so on. It indicates that in the Hebrew, it's not just an empirical or an emphatic statement followed up by a description. God created the heavens and the earth, period. Now, here's how he did it. It's not that kind of setting. It's saying he created the heavens and the earth, imperative, done, finished. And the earth was laid waste, became void and null. And the Spirit of God moved on the face of the water. And he recreated at that point. There are some theories that really look into the Bible and say there is some evidence that there was pre-existing cultures prior to Adam and Eve. There is some scant evidence by extrapolation that there was more here than just Adam, Eve, Cain, and Abel. And so, just by virtue of what we just talked about, where we went and built a city, married a wife, had a kid.
Hmm. All right. Well, your current book is, again,
The Secret History of the Reptilians.
Okay.
It's available, as my publisher would tell you, everywhere books are sold.
And the new one will be out in October.
In October. We're releasing at the Paradigm Symposium. If you happen to be there, we'll have a book release party.
Nice. Okay, and the website for the Paradigm Symposium?
ParadigmSymposium.com. And if you can't spell any of that, go to IntrepidMag.com and click on the Paradigm Symposium link.
Okay, now do you have your own personal website?
I do. It's just my full name. It's ScottAllenRoberts.com. And Allen, because there's so many different spellings of Allen, is A-L-A-N. So Scott AllenRoberts.com.
Okay, and the radio show you do is on tomorrow night?
Yes, Sunday night is our show.
Okay.
9 p.m. Central, 10 p.m. Eastern. Dr. John Ward joins us live from Luxor, where it's 4 a.m. And tomorrow we've got an interview with Robert Bivol. Okay. You can check it out. We're over at KGRARadio.com.
All right. Well, I thank you for the fascinating discussion tonight.
Thank you for having me. I sure appreciate it.
Well, maybe we can have you back on when your next book comes out.
Anytime.
We can talk about that in some more detail.
Absolutely.
All right. And everyone check out his websites, and that symposium sounds like it's going to be amazing.
It's going to be amazing. It's going to be 4 intense days of sitting under some pretty learned people.
All right, Last Exit for the Lost is up next. Here's Psyche Corporation taking you out.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? To perfection. 5, 8, 3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. get into the heart of the universe. Ventricles and atria, chambers number 1597. And counting. And counting.